And this is KPCW. Good morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour on this Wednesday, August 26th. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher as your host. It is 58 degrees, mostly cloudy skies in Old Town Park City at the moment. The high this afternoon will be 84. It's 61 and cloudy in the Heber Valley with a high of 91. ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes has details on the weather forecast for the Wasatch Back.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back on this Wednesday. Look for a mixture of clouds and sunshine as we go throughout the day. Just a very slim chance of a couple of pop-up storms, primarily in elevations above about 7,500 to 8,000 feet. High temperatures climbing into the mid-80s in Park City will be in the low 90s for us in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Thursday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies. Again, a very slim chance of a pop-up high-elevation storm. Otherwise, mainly dry and a mix of sun and clouds. With temperatures climbing into the mid-80s once again in Park City, we'll see those highs in the low to mid-90s in the Heber Valley. As we move into Friday, partly cloudy skies, a couple of isolated storms will be possible during the afternoon. A little better chance of pop-up storms, though, heading into your Friday evening. So we'll have to watch that for any of those high school football games that may be underway across the Wasatch Back. Temperatures will be in the low 80s for highs in Park City on Friday. We'll see those high temperatures climbing to around 90 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into the upcoming weekend, we will have some changes. A cold front. Yes, a cold front will be making its way towards the area as we go into the weekend, and that is going to bring us an increasing chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms for us, especially on our Saturday. Pretty good chance. In fact, it's likely that we see some showers and thunderstorms with the cold front moving through on your Saturday. High temperatures will cool down only into the mid-70s in Park City. We'll see high temperatures only around 80 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Sunday, we'll keep that good chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms in the forecast during the day. Temperatures only in the low 70s for highs in Park City. We'll see high temperatures in the upper 70s to near 80 in the Heber Valley. That's going to feel quite nice for us. As we head into early next week, we'll stick with the partly cloudy skies and a little unsettled with isolated thunderstorm chances continuing into your Monday and Tuesday. High temperatures will climb into the mid 70s both Monday and Tuesday afternoon, with highs climbing into the low 80s for us in the Heber Valley for your Monday and Tuesday. What's more interesting, temperatures for overnight lows dip down into the lower 40s in the Heber Valley as we head into your Sunday and Monday mornings. Let's look at your latest forecast with the Wasatch Back on ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And then just a preview of this morning's show. We will start the hour with Wasatch County Councilmember Eric Rowland. He has an update on preliminary municipalities here in the Wasatch Back. After that, Paul Cousson, the Vice President of Government Relations at the National Park Foundation, has updates on National Park Week, which is this week. And then finally, to close out the hour, we will hear from Mountainlands Technical College Vice President Joseph Demma. The Heber Valley campus of the Technical College is opening this week, and he has details about everything that that campus will have to offer for the Valley and for the region. That's all coming up right here on the Local News Hour. After that, stay tuned for The Mountain Life, starts at 9. And for this month's Resilient Youth episode, Randy Jo Greenberg reveals how simple yoga and mindfulness practices can give young people powerful tools for managing stress and building resilience. Then Dr. Claudia Kim takes a closer look at what summer does to our skin, why dark spots and fine lines become more noticeable after months of sun exposure, and what's actually happening beneath the surface. That is on The Mountain Life at 9 o'clock right here on KPCW. I will be back with some local news for you after this. The Park City Planning Commission will host a third public hearing for the 5-acre Bonanza Park proposal today. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the developer has lowered proposed building heights.
Locals will get another chance to weigh in on the 5-acre Bonanza Park proposal Wednesday. The Park City Planning Commission has been considering the plans since late June and has expressed concerns about building heights. Six of the seven structures planned were above the zoned 35-foot maximum and the 40-foot exception for gables. Now, the developer has reduced heights for five of the three-story buildings. To be closer to the zoned maximum, the new proposal shrinks residential floor heights from 9 to 8 feet and the commercial floors from 12 to 10 feet. Instead of having 12-by-12-foot gables, the pitches were reduced to 4-by-12. The changes limit the height from the finished floor to the parapet to about 35 feet, However, parts of the 120-foot-long buildings would still exceed 35 feet due to the site's slope. One building bordering Munchkin Road is proposed to remain four stories, but will have similar design adjustments to reduce its overall height. The commission will also review a comparison of parking demand for similar projects and traffic impacts. Wednesday's 5:30 p.m. meeting is in City Hall. Locals can attend in person or virtually. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, on the phone with me is Wasatch County Council Member Eric Rowland. Eric, good morning.
Good morning, Grace. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. You have agreed to come on the show to talk about a couple of hot button issues in the Wasatch Back right now. Preliminary municipalities, that's a mouthful, and state trust land. And I want to start with a little bit of background. First of all, can you just give listeners a 30-second overview of what a preliminary municipality is?
So a preliminary municipality is a concept that essentially allows the lieutenant governor to approve up to two requests per year that allows an entity to basically try and stand up a city. It's the process is all part of the law as far as what steps they have to go through. And if approved, it gives them kind of, it starts a clock for that entity to establish themselves as a municipality. If certain metrics aren't met or if certain processes aren't fulfilled, then there's consequences. It rolls back to either the county's administrative duties to oversee it, or it continues forward as a municipality.
Yeah. And this year, both applications that were accepted were right here in Wasatch County. So it's,
correct.
It's an issue that hits close to home for you and for the rest of the council.
It does. Yeah. From our understanding, it's a first come first serve. So whoever gets their applications in first are the ones that generally get the approval by the lieutenant governor. So, and to your point, the first two were both in Wasatch. And so it's been a challenge. We do have some concerns with this particular law. And we're hoping to get some resolution from or some relief. But yeah, it is concerning.
Yeah. And as you alluded to, so your council, the Wasatch County Council and the Summit County Council had a meeting a couple of weeks ago now talking about passing a resolution to maybe ask the state to repeal this pilot program. And in response to that, the governor's office didn't like that very much. One of his advisors, Steve Waltrip, said that counties who declare war on the state over growth issues are at risk of losing their funding. What was your first reaction when you heard that?
We were very surprised by that type of reaction. It almost felt like there was some misunderstanding, like we were establishing a militia to go against the state and overturn the governor and all laws. It felt just a very overreactive response when all we're suggesting is and asking for support to repeal a law. We're not trying to encourage anyone to break the law. It's the law. And obviously we will work around whatever the law states. And so we were very surprised by that response.
What exactly is it about preliminary municipalities that you and the Summit County Council are nervous about?
So we spend a lot of time talking with the citizens of the county, talking with staff, talking with a number of entities in order to establish a general plan, basically that states this is how we foresee the county should grow, should be developed. We establish zoning. We do a lot of work in order to make that plan. Preliminary municipalities just completely do away with that and essentially gives an entity the right to do what they want, where they want, when they want it. And in many cases, by design, it has no obligation whatsoever to follow whatever plan's been established by the county or a city. And so that makes it extremely challenging for us. Mm-hmm. As a consequence, those that have been approved for Wasatch, they fall well outside of our approved general plan. And so it creates a lot of concerns. We understand the intent of what they're trying to accomplish. We just don't think that execution is in any way sustainable. It doesn't work in conjunction with our local governing entities. It makes it very, very challenging.
Yeah, I hear you. I heard from Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh that some folks from Wasatch County are hoping to meet with the governor's office later this week. From your perspective, what would be the ideal outcome of that conversation?
It's going to be myself and Dustin that are going to be going on Friday to meet with them. And my hope is, again, we understand what they're trying to accomplish. There's a high housing crisis in Utah that can be defined in a number of different ways. We understand the governor has this initiative to try and increase affordable housing opportunities, provide more housing opportunities for different wage earners. We get that. And my hope would be that we can come to the table and say, hey, we have some ideas. We have some potential solutions that could work very, very well for Wasatch County. So rather than supporting programs that go completely against what we're trying to accomplish, how about let's work together and figure out a solution that works for both? To me, that would be an ideal outcome, is to walk away with that feeling that we're working together, we're not working against each other.
Yeah, and it sounds like you believe there's been some miscommunication. I imagine you want the governor to know that Wasatch County and Summit County aren't breaking the law.
Right, yeah, we're not coming down to the steps looking to take over the government. We're not trying to break any laws. That's not what we're doing at all, and we've never even come close to even stating that. And so, yeah, we'd love to realign those misconceptions and go, hey, where did that come from? That was not what we were saying at all. This is what we're trying to accomplish, and let's try and come up with a solution together.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting to me that, so we saw four applications for preliminary municipalities. My goodness, I don't know why I can't say that this morning, but four applications in Summit and Wasatch counties combined this year alone. I'm curious if you have thoughts on why it seems like the Wasatch PAC is disproportionately seeing these applications.
I think it's because we have tried to really hold firm to how we want these general plans to roll out and our zoning. And because the land here is so valuable, I get a sense that developers are just frustrated that they can't do what they want, when they want it, where they want it. And so rather than working or trying to find solutions that do work with our general plan, they're sidestepping us, going straight to the state and saying, hey, give us what we want, because the counties aren't doing what we want. And with that developer pressure, we're seeing the state create these laws and these processes that completely circumvent what's happening on the local level. At least that's my theory, because when we look at what's being proposed as far as these preliminary municipalities, it fits that theory. These are entities who have come to the county saying, hey, we don't like the zoning where this land is. We want more density. And we're saying, no, there's a very specific reason why we've established the density and the zoning that it is. They don't like it. They go to the state and go try and get what they want.
Yeah. To your point, what would be a better solution for achieving affordable housing, since that's one of the governor's goals in Wasatch County in the Heber Valley?
I think the whole concept of how affordable housing has been traditionally looked at is very old school. It doesn't fit the model when you look at how real estate works. It's all about the monthly payment. If you can get a monthly payment for a person who falls within their budget, you could create affordable housing opportunities. I think the way that we're looking at it is completely wrong. Working with real estate agents, those who are in lending, they have some really interesting solutions that could make this far more achievable than creating these mandates that are, for all intents and purposes, impossible for a government entity to actually try and achieve. Whereas if we try and create processes that brings that payment down month to month and does make it affordable, you have a lot more opportunities for people. And so my hope is, by getting the right people at the table, those who have traditionally not been part of the conversation, you can find solutions that work and also doesn't create a burden on the taxpayer. So that's part of that conversation we hope to have. It's ongoing. We've got some people here locally in the county that we're bringing into this conversation. And I'm excited. From everything we've been hearing so far, there's very doable solutions just looked at through a lens that hasn't been traditionally looked at.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to see how these conversations continue to evolve. Will Summit County be joining you at the meeting on Friday?
I haven't heard if they are. I know myself and the county manager are going. There might be some others, but I'm not sure. I haven't seen the full list yet, but I do know the two of us are going. So.
Okay. Do you think there's still an appetite at the Wasatch County Council for asking the state to repeal the pilot program?
Yes, very much so. We think the bill is just fundamentally flawed, and the approach they're taking is just not sustainable. Mm-hmm. So we'd love to just see it repealed, start over, and actually come to the table with the intent of working with counties to find a solution rather than just creating a law that has absolutely no input from counties.
Okay.
Yeah,
we've been spending this whole conversation so far on preliminary municipalities, but trust land is another piece of the puzzle. Could you share briefly how that fits into the conversation?
So they are, in this particular case, related. The one preliminary municipality application is running directly adjacent to one of those state trust lands, at CITLA. There are some related conversations about the two. And so there has been, I think, some overflow from one conversation to the next. It has been influencing, we believe, the reaction from the governor's office because of that. That isn't always the case, but I think with our particular situation, it is because, again, the application for the preliminary was directly adjacent to this CITLA conversation, and they do relate. And so, yeah, there is, in this case, some crossover.
Yeah. Do you think it's possible to find a solution where the state can monetize that land east of Heber, and Wasatch County will also like the solution it comes up with?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We're actually talking with Heber City, with personnel there, to see if there's a solution where we can look at potentially some land swaps deals. There's some other opportunities in the county. Again, this is where I think it's so important for individuals who are involved in these decisions to try and talk to each other. You can accomplish and solve any problem through conversation by trying to figure out who are you working with, what are their wants, what are their needs, and coming to the table with solutions. We have, I think, some very exciting opportunities for that land that can be involved in some kind of swap, that can be involved with some kind of trade. Where if the city or the state needs something established from that land, there's ways we can do that. If they're looking to just place a bunch of affordable housing units in that land, it's going to be extremely challenging because this land in question is clear out on the outskirts of the county. It's not good for – that's not a place that would be effective for affordable housing. There's no infrastructure out there. So again, if we can have those conversations and people are open to those conversations, we can find a better solution. We just need to be able to come to the table and have that conversation.
Yeah. When do you think each of these issues will be back before the council?
Good question. Definitely, I think in the coming weeks, if not months, we are waiting for some responses. There could be some outcomes after Friday that could help, make that timeline faster. So we'll see how things go after this week.
Fair enough. Well, I will be curious to hear more after Friday.
You and me both.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. In our last few minutes of this conversation, I want to just chat briefly about MIDA. That's the Military Installation Development Authority. And that, you know, they have land use authority over a part of the county where we're seeing quite a lot of growth. I'm curious how it's been to serve on the MIDA board over the past few months.
So it's been fine. We've had two meetings. Both have been virtual. There's been a lot of I think, appropriately so, some concerns and kind of reevaluations based on the situations in Box Elder County with the Stratus project. So it's been, you know, it's been, again, we've only had two meetings and both were virtual. And so nothing, I mean, at least so far has been too, I would say, overly exciting. They're typical government meetings that you go through an agenda and just kind of address the items. Mm-hmm. We are, from our conversations with the state, this next legislative cycle will have, and I think there's already a couple of dozen bills that are going to be presented to help better define what MIDA is. And so because there's already a kind of some knowledge of those bills being drafted, we're all kind of wondering, well, what is it going to look like? Like, how will this, you know, it could be a very, very different organization at the end of this next legislative cycle. So there's kind of this, let's see and wait and see what happens, and kind of just business as usual until then. But yeah, it's been, for lack of a better word, fine.
Yeah.
Like most other board assignments, you show up, listen, go through the meeting and adjourn.
Yeah. Although MIDA, I think, has been getting a little bit more public attention than some of the other boards you probably serve on.
Yeah. And I think that's being virtual. It's hard to see that attention because we're not in person. And so when you're on a virtual meeting, it's very difficult to know just how many people are actually, you know, watching and attending. So it's very isolated at this point.
Yeah. Can you give me any more insight into what some of that legislation might look like?
I've just so far heard a lot of rumors, everything from completely changing what MIDA does to there's been some proposals to try and get rid of it altogether. There's been a lot of discussion about more transparency, conflict of interest requirements. And again, just from different rumor mills that have been going around from different legislators who are putting together some draft legislation. But it'll be interesting. But there's going to be quite a bit, I think, presented. Last count I heard, there's 35 or 38 potential bills that relate to MIDA that are being drafted right now. And I'm sure that number will probably increase.
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a departure from recent legislative sessions.
Yeah. There'll be a lot of focus on it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, on the Wasatch County front, in our last minute or so, anything else that you that's coming up that you'd like listeners to be aware of?
I think just always as much involvement as people can. We love hearing from the public. If you can't attend our meetings, please email us. I think people would be surprised. Like it's interesting how most of the time we don't hear a lot from people, but when there are some hot topic subjects, then we'll get a flood of emails. It would be, I think in most cases, hearing consistently from the electorate would be, it's always really nice. And so I always like to encourage people, please come to our meetings, please email us, please let us know what you're thinking, please let us know what's on your mind. Your feedback is very influential in how we move forward with our decisions. So, and as always, if you know, encourage people to become even more involved, sign up for our boards, apply for different assignments, run for office. The more participation we have from people, to me, you always get a better outcome. And so our county is one of, if not one of the fastest growing counties in the state. And we need that feedback from people. There's a lot of decisions that are being made very quickly. And so the more input we get, the better I think we will all be.
Well, yes. Well, Wasatch County Council Member Eric Rollins, thank you so much for joining the show this morning.
Thank you, Grace. It was a pleasure.
It's been great to talk to you. Well, on the line is Paul Cousson, the Vice President of Government Relations at the National Park Foundation. Paul, good morning and happy National Park Week.
Happy National Park to you too, Grace. Great to be on.
Thank you so much for joining the show this morning. To get started, I want to understand, you work for the National Park Foundation, and that's different from the National Park Service. Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about what's the difference between the two organizations?
Sure. So we are the official nonprofit partner of the National Park Service. We are here created by Congress almost 60 years ago to support the Park Service however we can. We depend on private donations, and that money goes right back to support our national parks, whether it's helping to build trails or working on issues like housing for park rangers in parks all over the country, to telling more stories about the places, the histories at these sites. You name it, we're there to support the Park Service however we can.
Okay, and what does your role with government relations involve?
Sure, so I get to really champion national parks on Capitol Hill, meet with elected officials, and highlight the good news, the good stories around the national parks day in and day out. Just yesterday, we were up in Gettysburg with a group of congressional staff, showing them the park, highlighting the partnerships between the National Park Service, the National Park Foundation, and other groups that support the park. And, you know, it's really a joy every day to get to find ways to support our national parks around the country.
Okay, so it sounds like you probably get to enjoy visiting a lot of parks in your work. That's a cool part of your job, I imagine.
It is. And I've always been a national park enthusiast, if you will. So it's definitely brought me to some new places, but it's been a great opportunity to experience these places, see more of them, and also learn more about these incredible places. Yeah. And the backstories that go into them.
Yeah. Well, I hope you've been able to enjoy some of Utah's parks.
I have indeed. I've been to three of the Mighty Five, Arches, Zion, and Canyonlands.
All right.
So I need to get back and get to Capitol Reef and Bryce Canyon.
Yeah, cross the rest off your bucket list.
Yes, absolutely.
Why are national parks important to this country?
So they tell our story. I mean, you think of the incredible places, the ones I mentioned in Utah, and all across the country, from the Everglades to Yellowstone and Yosemite. But they also include places like Gettysburg, the Statue of Liberty, Independence Hall, Golden Spike in northern Utah, places that really tell the American story. It's really our putting our best face forward to the rest of the world, and even to Americans themselves who want to go and see and experience these places. It's been said many times that national parks are America's best idea. And so it's very important to the National Park Foundation to find ways to support the Park Service and make sure these places continue to thrive for years and years to come.
Yeah. Under the current administration, we have seen some cuts to funding and staffing for the parks. We've also seen a decline in the number of international visitors in particular. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the current climate and one, how maybe smaller staffs or smaller budgets affect the visitor experience. Mm-hmm. Let's just start there, actually.
Yeah, well, the good thing is you have groups like the National Park Foundation and other groups on the ground, Zion Forever, Friends of Arches and Canyonlands, that all work together with the national parks to support the parks and the Park Service however and wherever we can, in particular through private donations that go to enhance and support the parks where they are. You know, one major investment that has been made in our national parks over the last few years is the Legacy Restoration Fund. And, you know, for everything that comes out of Washington, this is probably one of those rare bipartisan moments where you had everybody coming together to say, we want to invest in our national parks. And over the years, you know, as different priorities get shifted around, in our parks, some infrastructure has gotten put on the back burner, whether it's roads and bridges and campgrounds. Congress saw this and said, we need to make an investment. They created the Legacy Restoration Fund, which has deployed about $6.5 billion to support our national parks. And what's really good about that is while these things need to get taken care of, the parks can focus on other things as this infusion of investments come into their parks. And just in Utah, we've seen the South Campground at Zion got a major facelift, a multi-million dollar facelift over the last few years, an incredible bipartisan investment. But more work needs to be done. There are projects at Canyonlands to improve the water infrastructure and the electrical infrastructure in the park. So making sure that this continues is really how we can step up and ensure that our parks are in good shape moving forward.
Okay. Well, thanks for giving Utah examples. That's helpful.
Absolutely.
But I'm curious, how much do national parks rely on help from organizations like the National Park Foundation and other private donations? Like, how much can parks sustain themselves through things like entrance fees from visitors versus mm-hmm. how much other help do they need?
I mean, we're there to support where we can. The Park Service annual budget is billions and billions of dollars. We can make a significant chunk, hundreds of millions of dollars, but the Park Services do depend on robust funding from Congress. Mm-hmm. They do depend on, in key places, entry fees. But you know, the parks, we have so many people that come to these places. They, in a lot of ways, do invest in themselves. So we want to make sure that those investments continue. We want to make sure that where we can support the parks in ways that folks may not think need the support. Like, we just put out $10 million in our first round of innovation grants a couple of weeks ago. And this is to address things that you may not think need to be taken care of in parks. But when you enter a park and you can't find a parking spot, that's something that comes to mind. So making it easier for visitors to find parking spots is one thing that we're investing in. Drones to help with rescue missions that the Park Service can deploy. That's a key thing that folks may not think about, but groups like the National Park Foundation and nonprofit partners on the ground are asking these questions directly to the parks. Where do you need us? Where can we invest private donations to support our national parks? And so that's really key to making sure these places thrive. You have the big investments coming in from Congress, but it takes a lot of work from partners at the national level to partners that are the eyes and ears and are on the ground supporting the individual park units day in and day out to make sure these places thrive.
Yeah. So certainly the parks themselves need economic support, but the parks then in turn provides a lot of economic benefits to their local communities. Could you share a little bit about that?
Sure. Just in the last couple of years in Utah alone, visitors spent $2 billion in the state visiting national parks. I mean, that's a tremendous investment. And you think of places like Springdale and Moab that are just outside some of these national parks. They depend on a functioning national park. They depend on the visitors that come in and want to spend time in these places. Visitors will invest in these local communities. They will stay in lodges in these towns. They will buy supplies they need, eat at restaurants. And so there's a great relationship that we see between the gateway communities and these parks, and definitely a ripple effect when there are investments made in the parks to make sure they are in pristine condition. People want to stay longer, they want to spend more time, and in turn, they want to invest in the local communities just outside the park. So it is a great relationship between the parks and the communities around them, and we want to make sure that those continue to thrive.
Yeah. In your years with the Park Foundation, have you grown to love a favorite park?
God, there are so many good ones. It's really hard to say. I will say when I went to Arches for the first time and just, you know, it takes your breath away that how is this planet Earth in some ways? Like, how is this here? It's just incredible. But there are so many places. I mean, 433 sites around the country. It's difficult to say there's one absolute favorite. There are so many near communities all over the country. So I encourage folks, get out, explore some near you, and then get out and make those great American road trips to see these incredible places that we are working with the Park Service and with Congress to support and protect.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you would like to leave listeners with as we look ahead to the rest of National Park Week?
So, you know, there's a lot going on in our parks. We're working to support them. I mentioned the Legacy Restoration Fund. There is legislation to continue it right now. The America the Beautiful Act, which has wide bipartisan support from members across the country. We want to make sure that gets across the finish line this year. I'll also encourage folks visit our webpage, nationalparks.org, to learn more about the investments that we're making in national parks and how you can support parks on the ground as well.
Gotcha. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for this morning. But Paul, thank you so much for your insights.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Great to be with you.
We've been talking with Paul Cusson of the National Park Foundation in honor of National Park Week. Well, on the phone with me is Mountainland Technical College Vice President Joseph Demma. Joseph, good morning.
Good morning, Grace. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Thank you so much for being here. It is a big week for MTech. Congratulations. You're opening a new campus this week.
We are. Thank you. We're very excited to bring Utah's best of state technical college to the Wasatch Back.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about how you chose Heber as the home for your sixth campus here in Utah.
Sure. Thank you. So just by way of a little bit of background, Mountain Land Technical College is one of eight technical colleges in the state of Utah, and each one of us has a service region. And so the Mountain Land service region is Utah County, Summit County, and Wasatch County. And for the last 37 years, Mountain Land has done a really good job of offering and delivering technical education to Utah County. But we haven't had the resources to help really support the economic engines of Summit or Wasatch counties in the way we've wanted to. A few years ago, we were approached by the Wasatch County School District Superintendent, who mentioned that that school district was proposing a new high school, which ultimately became Deer Creek High School, and they were really interested to see if Mountain Land wanted to partner on the property and with service delivery. So really the expansion became, I think, was driven by two reasons. One, that Wasatch and Summit counties were underserved in terms of technical education delivery, and two, the local community was extending an olive branch, which ultimately became a donation of the land up there for us. And so that perfect storm created an opportunity where we were then able to do some economic research and labor market analytics to see, could the community sustain a full-throated technical college? And in fact, all those stars aligned, and then the legislature did appropriate the money for us to build the campus. So we're really excited for folks to have an opportunity to explore technical education in their backyard and not have to travel very far to do it.
Yeah. So it sounds like a whole lot of things really came together. I want to return to the school district piece in a couple of minutes, but first, could you share an overview of what kinds of programs the Heber campus will offer?
Yeah. So ultimately, we expect our Heber campus to hold all of our programs. We have five schools. Right now, we've opened up programs in four of our schools. So we have our School of Apprenticeships. So we'll have electrical and plumbing apprenticeship is there now. Our School of Healthcare, which is Mountain Land's largest school. And so inside of that program in Heber, we've got things like dental assisting, pharmacy technician, nurse assistant, medical assistant, emergency medical technician. We also have our School of Services, so this is going to be your cosmetology and culinary arts programs. And then we have our Clyde School of Trades. So in Heber, we have diesel welding and then automotive technology.
Okay. Wow. So a whole range of offerings.
Yeah, and with plans to expand, because we have a School of Technology, which has everything from, we have an AI program we're going to be launching, but it also has digital marketing, custom. There's a lot of cool opportunities inside of our technology programs, which we will be bringing to Heber in phase two of our rollout.
Okay, much to look forward to. You kind of alluded to the fact that up until this point, there haven't been as many technical career offerings for the Heber Valley.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, when you and maybe your advisory board are looking at shaping a curriculum, how do you use different economic trends or input from community members to decide what to put in your curriculum?
Thank you. That's a great question. I think what makes the technical college system in Utah so unique is the breadth and depth of our partnerships. And one of those key partners are our advisory boards. So we have upwards of 600 advisory board members across our 38 programs. So each one of those advisory board members is either an HR representative or a subject matter expert or administrator of a particular business who helps us write the curriculum for those programs. And they not only help us write that curriculum, but then they help us sustain it, and we revisit it multiple times each year. There are so many programs where industry changes need to be reflected inside of the classroom, and we're able to do that real time with our industry partners. So the on-the-ground human beings that help inform our programs are critical and key. Another piece we use is a group called Lightcast, which is an economic modeling labor market analytics firm, which helps us identify trend lines within specific geographic areas. So not only sort of what's a snapshot of what the labor market looks like, but what are the predictive analytics moving forward? So for example, when we look at Wasatch and Summit counties, we're talking to business leaders who are saying, hey, we need more pharmacist technicians. Okay, so then we take that information, we start to think about what a curriculum would look like for pharmacy tech in that community, and then we go to the data that says, okay, in fact, there's a 19.8% year-over-year job growth in pharmacy tech for Summit County, but a 44% one in Wasatch County. And then we're able to dive into that data a little bit more to say, okay, these communities could sustain our graduates. That means they could be employed. And so that's the key driver for us, is employability of our graduates. So not only does the community want it, but the graduates need to have a place where they can work. And so all of that has to come together. And for us, it was all green lights when we started to look at industry areas in Wasatch and Summit counties that matched up and aligned specifically with our programs. And the growth in those two counties is such that we were able to say, yeah, not only will students attend these programs, but in fact, when they graduate, they're going to have real job opportunities there.
Okay. How many graduates go on to work in the fields that they study at MTech?
So in the neighborhood of 89% of them.
Oh, wow. That's a large percentage.
So, and that's another key distinction of the technical colleges in Utah, because we don't just, so we are measured by several things, but one of those is related job placement. So our graduates, so if we have an auto technology graduate, we are measured by whether that auto technology graduate gets a job in automotive technology. It doesn't count for us if that automotive technician goes and becomes a welder. That actually counts against us. And so this is where we align with student intent, what the workforce is needing, and then we connect those graduates to those employment opportunities. So for us, we're measured in a very real way based on related employment. And so our completion, placement, and licensure numbers, you know, are always above what the accreditors want, but we're really, really proud that 89% of our students find a job within that first few months of graduation, and they stay in the local communities. So we're really excited about what this opportunity brings, not just for students in Wasatch and Summit counties, but what it means for the workforce and the economy there.
Yeah, and you told me a little bit about this already with the land donation from the school district, but it is right next door to the high school. Tell me a little bit about how those students fit into MTech.
Yeah, they fit in a very real way. One of the things that we enjoy as a technical college is that we serve both the secondary student as well as adult students. And so for if you're a high school student, you can attend Mountainland Technical College tuition-free, so you don't pay any tuition at all. So being located right on the same sort of property line as Deer Creek High School provides all those students that opportunity to walk across the parking lot and engage in college-level coursework tuition-free. So not only would they end up with their program with a certificate in an industry-certified area, but then if they wanted to, they could take that certificate and transfer up to 30 credits towards their bachelor's degree at Utah State University or Utah Valley University or any number of post-secondary education institutions we have. So if you're a high school student, this is a remarkable opportunity to attend tuition-free, get a certificate that's going to get you a job that pays you good money in a field that you like to work in, and you can ultimately transfer that for 30 credits towards a bachelor's degree. So it's a win-win-win all around for a high school student.
Wow, that's exciting. What about for other students who have left high school? Do you welcome people who are trying to make a career pivot, for example, who might be more non-traditional students?
Absolutely. And 70% of our student population are those students. So they're adults that are looking to either reskill, retool, restart, or just dive into a field that they've always wanted to work in. And so 70% of our students are adult students in these program areas, and we offer very low competitive tuition. So you're going to be enrolling in an institution that it doesn't cost a lot of money. In fact, the way we structure our tuition and the scholarships and financial aid opportunities we have show that 99% of our graduates are graduating debt-free. So they're not taking out student loans. We're able to connect them to scholarships. So if you're a high school student, you're coming tuition-free. And if you're an adult student, please explore our scholarship opportunities, because we have a whole team of people that wants you to get out of your education program without having to pay any student debt.
Okay. What do you anticipate the size of the student body in the Heber Valley will be?
So we have planned for our facility will handle in the neighborhood of 1,100 students in a given kind of semester. Right now, what we've been able to open, we're anticipating about 675 this first 18 months. But ultimately, we expect it to be a flagship campus for us, just like Lehigh is and just like Payson's turning out to be.
Okay. Yeah. And then could you just talk briefly about what the economic benefit to the Heber community and the broader Wasatchback community will be?
Yeah. So anytime one of our graduates enters the workforce, and again, 89% of them do, there's an instant benefit to the community. So not only is it a hiring event where that person now has a good-paying, family-sustaining job, but there's the residual economic factors related to them being employed. So they're spending money at their grocery store. They're paying for utilities. They're using the economic resources within that community. So what happens is it ends up having a value way beyond the salary of that graduate. So if an average M-Tech student graduate salary is in the neighborhood of $60,000, we have an economic impact per graduate every year of about $260,000 into that community every year. So a graduate is generating that kind of economic impact in these local communities. So we expect in our first year graduates in Heber Valley, we'll have an economic return to that community of about $129 million.
Wow.
That's money that stays right in Summit and Wasatch counties in terms of the businesses that it's supporting.
Okay. So your ribbon cutting, I believe, is on Friday. When's the first day of class?
So first day of class was last week. It was August 17th, and we were ready to go, and we moved in our students on the 17th. We're going to officially cut the ribbon this Friday at 10 a.m. at our Heber Valley campus. It's open to the community. There's going to be guided tours and self-guided tours of what we believe is, I believe, is our most beautiful campus that we have in our system. So we're excited to bring our programs to the Valley and to share our wonderful facilities with the community.
All right. Well, thank you so much for all of these details. Where can people go to learn more?
To learn more, we have a Heber Valley specific webpage. So that's mtec.edu/Heber.
Fantastic. Well, Joseph, thank you so much for your time.
Grace, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We have been talking with Joseph Demma, the vice president of Mountainland Technical College. The college's Heber Valley campus is now open with a ribbon cutting on Friday. You're listening to KPCW Park City. As always, you can find all your Wasatch Back news anytime, anywhere at kpcw.org. We also have an app, so feel free to download that too. And you can take KPCW with you wherever you go. Thank you for listening like a local and making KPCW part of your morning.